Welcome to Puentes a la Comunidad, Bridges to the Community. Hello, I'm your host, Emily Guerra. My guest on this edition is New Mexico State University Associate Professor of Criminal Justice, Dr. Mike Tapia, to talk to us about his new book, Gangs of the El Paso-Juarez Borderland. Thank you for joining me again.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
You're welcome. 2 years ago, we visited about your book, The Barrio Gangs of San Antonio. And at that time, you were also doing research on the El Paso Borderland gangs.
Yeah, I was in full swing with my field work at that time. We spoke 2017, and I had arrived at New Mexico State in 2015 and really just hit the ground running on the El Paso project.
How similar or how different are the two books?
Well, there are obvious similarities, and they both address barrio gangs historically in two large southwestern cities with deep histories with Chicano populations and high poverty and all that. So the contexts are very similar. But there are some important differences, too, just based on regional factors and, you know, different history that has unraveled in both places.
Like what?
Well, El Paso is, the quintessential border city. You know, it's probably the biggest border crossing, you know, with Mexico, aside from San Isidro and Tijuana in San Diego. But San Antonio is not. You know, it's quite retirado from the border. You know, it's closest to Laredo, about 2.5 hours north of Laredo. So that already conditions it as a different type of place.
The borderland gangs as opposed to the San Antonio gangs. Are they different?
The main thing to underline there, I would say, is the intensity of the pachuquismo, right? So that's for those listeners that aren't familiar with that term, you know, that's the zoot suit style of dress and attitude and, you know, whole subculture. And while San Antonio did pick up on that, and it's, you know, 1940s, 50s era, street gang members were really fond of that style and mimicked it as much as possible. Regionally, it was somewhat, you know, distant from its origin, which is El Paso Juarez.
In doing your research, how far back were you able to find some of the original gangs or some gangs that are still around?
Yeah, since El Paso is really what I consider to be the epicenter of this phenomenon, of this, you know, 100 or so year phenomenon, that's about as far back as you can find evidence of these groups in, you know, archives, newspaper archives, or oral histories. There are some really rich, great sources at UTEP Special Collections, for example, oral histories of persons that lived through those eras, you know, the 1930s, for example. So that was really a gem of a find in terms of research of original sources and capturing sort of the essence and the ambiance of, you know, what El Paso, Segundo Barrio, and some of these neighborhoods that are really well noted for being highly concentrated with these unsupervised groups of delinquent boys milling about street corners and up to mischief and things of that nature.
Were they also into drugs?
Yes and no. I mean, it's bringing things or putting them in a modern perspective. It's definitely not the drugs that we know about today. But yeah, there were accounts of, you know, if there are any listeners out there that remember, there was a product called Sneaky Pete liquor. And you can find some of that in the oral histories as being, you know, kind of a really cheap staple that the boys could get their hands on. They smoked marijuana, you know, and heroin was already around at that time. And it tended to be pretty similar in that regard. You know, human nature is such that we, you know, have been self-medicating, you know, in the barrio and in the ghettos for quite some time. So, yeah, I guess, you know, now that I hear myself talking about it, there probably are as many similarities to today.
What about their language? They had something different as well.
Yeah, that definitely has taken a turn. And so here's one thing, you know, a page I can recall, you know, pulling from the San Antonio project, is that the elders that I interviewed there, you know, gang members, barrio gang members from the 1950s, this is one thing that they were really adamant about and made sure that I understood really well, is that the difference between their era, I guess, and kids from today, Chicano boys that are in gangs today, were those subcultural markers, you know, the loss of language, the loss of the inner city Chicano slang. You know, today our Chicano gang boys are not really adept at that. You know, a lot of them, you know, either have lost their Spanish or Spanglish or slang, you know, street slang use completely, or it's of a different nature. You know, it mimics kind of the inner city ghetto or African American type dialect. And so that was seen by elders in the San Antonio Project as quite of a travesty. I didn't really get that reaction here from elders in the El Paso sample, because El Paso, it has retained a lot of that. You know, El Paso has like a really great, like one of the best car shows underneath what they refer to as the Spaghetti Bowl, or, you know, the Mixmaster freeway system in central El Paso. And that's an old barrio called Lincoln Park. And, you know, when you attend these annual really large car shows, lowrider shows and whatnot, you hear a lot of this stuff. It reminds me of what, you know, 1960 or 1950s might have sounded like, you know, just in terms of the chatter. I also asked a question, you know, some of my research subjects were, I interviewed jail guards, right, or prison correctional officers at here at Southern New Mexico Prison, throughout El Paso and different places. And I'd ask them that question, you know, I'd say, so are your, you know, modern day gangsters, you know, some of today's, I guess, you know, worst of the worst, if you will, or the most deeply embedded in crime these days, I asked them, are they Afrocentrized? Is their language ghettoized? Which is what I found in different regions of Texas, like San Antonio and Houston and places like that, Dallas, where you have Chicano gang members basically sounding like young black gang members. You know, they grow up in their midst and they do mimic their speech, comes from rap music and stuff. And the guards' response was almost unequivocally like, no, you know, our guys still champion, you know, the use of the old school language. They really look up to prison gang members who really still employ that type of lingo. And so that's one really stark contrast, I guess, between El Paso and San Antonio's gang subcultures. You know, and gangsters, you know, that grew up in El Paso's east side, which is all new development, right? So those kids have been sort of isolated from truly barrio contexts. And then, you know, same could be said probably for the kids that grew up in El Paso's northeast side, which tends to be pretty heavily concentrated with black gangs like the Bloods and the Crips and the Folk Nation. And then Las Cruces as well, right? Because chapter two of this book focuses on Las Cruces and its gang history. And that goes back to the 50s. And, you know, back then it's going to resemble very much what you have in the borderland region in terms of, you know, Juarez and El Paso speech, language and culture patterns. But, you know, you have another generation that came of age in the 90s and 2000s. And yeah, I found that they were, you know, very much ghettoized in their language, their thought processes, and also their behavior, you know, in terms of their violence patterns. And, you know, it's worth noting that Latino populations, gangs included, are not nearly as violent as African-American gangs and criminal subgroups. So that's, you know, also something to be, I guess, highlighted in this type of research.
The people that you interviewed, or the gang members, were they from prison? Were they in prisons? Had they been in prison?
Most of them, yeah. You know, that's unfortunately, that's usually a sign of a mark of legitimacy that, you know, someone who is claiming to have knowledge of this subculture and lifestyle has been ensnared in the juvenile or criminal justice system at some point in their life. And the experience inside, you know, penitentiary only, you know, really entrenches them in, you know, a lot of the knowledge and thought processes and actual, you know, what police call intelligence, you know, like who's selling what and who's doing what and, you know, who's, you know, kind of word on the street type of, you know, networking and word of mouth type stuff. So yeah, for the most part, those are the best sources of information, but not necessarily all the time. You have, for example, I credit a self-made historian from El Paso named Fred Morales, who went to Bowie in Segundo Barrio, who was, you know, just like myself, grew up in that environment, didn't necessarily partake of it himself, but as a historian, could point me to rich sources of information, knew a lot of the guys and gangs. It kind of served as a gatekeeper, if you will, to point me to people that would be really hard to find on my own. So yeah, good sources of information and, you know, resourceful people come pop out of the woodwork from, you know, unlikely places in this kind of work too.
In talking to some of these gang members, were there regrets of having belonged to a gang, or were they proud of being in a gang?
It depends on when you catch them in their life cycle. There are some folks that truly never age out of it, but those are in the minority. You know, since this is a book about history, well, you know, you're interviewing people of all different eras, or, you know, who have gone through that phase in their life at different, you know, let's say decades. You know, I'm interviewing guys that were familiar with the 1950s and who would be now in their 80s, early 80s, you know, and so on, right? It just goes on down the line. Guys that are now in their 70s would be familiar with the 1960s, or, you know, they were teens in that era. So folks like that, or I would say maybe some of the most interesting age group is guys that are about in my age group, you know, that in their 40s, who are seeing now things that they've missed. You know, their grandchildren are growing up, and, you know, it was something like that that really made them wake up and, you know, realize that they needed to drop the criminal lifestyle.
So that's the most interesting age group that you found, the ones in the 40s?
Yes, because when we were teens, you know, in the early 90s, that was bar none the most violent era in gang history. The 1950s, you know, across the Southwest was pretty violent as well, but the nature of it was different. You know, it was the violence was a lot more up close and personal, tied to what I call tools of the trade, you know. In the 90s, you had the advent of and widespread use of automatic, semi-automatic weapons. And, you know, you could do a lot of damage from a distance. And it really showed in the violent crime rates. And gangs was like almost like a fad at that time. You know, it was so widespread that even good kids, so-called good kids, you know, jocks and what have you, kind of got sucked into it. So it was a really violent era. And, you know, to see guys that have lived through that and been released from prison or what have you, you know, reflect on those crazy days, if you will. You know, they really have come a long way. So, yeah, it does tend to be a pretty interesting age group to study.
What do you see the future of gangs in the next 10, 20 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. In the preface of the book, or I guess some of the opening intro portions of the book, I make the claim that one of the reasons it was important to do this work is that because in the last 10 to 15 years, what we traditionally have known as barrio gangs, that is, you know, groups, territorial groups that have a, you know, tradition and history and a longevity, you know, used to hang out on street corners and claim turf and have really public displays of who they were. And these days, with, you know, the advent of social media and, you know, just drastic advances in communication technology and, you know, cell phone use being abundant and widespread, it seems to have lost that public form of expression. Probably what law enforcement has done also in terms of reacting to the gang issue has made them go underground. So yeah, these are some of the changes that we've seen over time as well.
Well, we can learn more about gangs from your book and coming up this Saturday, December the 21st at Coas Bookstore in downtown Las Cruces from 1 to 3. There's another book signing to get to know you and to get the book signed.
Yeah, definitely. I encourage folks to come out and visit. And these usually tend to be really nice events where we sit around and chat and just exchange stories and stuff.
And the book is available at Amazon.com, Gangs of El Paso Juarez Borderland. Thank you so much for coming down and talking to us, Dr. Mike Tapia, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice here at New Mexico State University.
Thanks, Emily. Always nice to chat with you.
You're welcome. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Emily Guerra.